the app that helps Venezuelans find food today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. People in Venezuela are struggling to meet their basic needs. Many now rely on a group messaging app for crucial information.
Where they can get some food, where is a gas station where there is a line that is less than 5 hours. It's a total chaos in Venezuela right now.
Also, amid tough stories from the southern border, the former U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Roberta Jacobson, tells us what leaders in both countries need to hear.
I have been hearing for years from Americans along the U.S.-Mexican border that neither Mexico City nor Washington understands the border.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Blackouts, water shortages, and a healthcare system at its knees, Venezuelans are desperate for a solution. Opposition leader Juan Guaido claims to be just that. The U.S. and many Western and South American countries recognize Guaido as Venezuela's new president, but Nicolas Maduro refuses to give up power. And ratcheting up that power struggle, the Venezuelan court now wants to strip Guaido of immunity from prosecution. The BBC's Will Grant is in Caracas.
I think it's another step in the direction of sort of adding more pressure to Mr. Guaido's shoulders. Of course, he says that's completely illegitimate because the only people who can strip immunity is the parliament itself, of which he is the head, and that's not about to happen. However, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is a loyalist to President Maduro. We fully expect them to ratify it at some point.
What are Venezuelans saying about this proposal to strip Guaido of immunity from prosecution?
At this stage, I think most Venezuelans are concerned with much more mundane issues. They're trying to make ends meet. They're trying to get water amid the water shortages. They're trying to survive with no power. They're trying to get food when no bank card machines are working anywhere in the country. You know, they're much more concerned about the fact their children aren't going to school. Of course, they've got an eye on the politics, more than an eye on the politics. They're watching it carefully. And his supporters would be up in arms if he is arrested or put under house arrest or something like that. But right now, I would say that most Venezuelans are far more concerned about day-to-day survival than they are about the well-being of the political classes.
As for President Maduro, he recently said he will allow some aid into the country, which was kind of the first admission on his part that things are not good for Venezuelans right now. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's absolutely significant as well, isn't it? I mean, it's not just a recognition of things not being good. It's a recognition of a humanitarian crisis. The Red Cross compared the operation that they would put in place in Venezuela to the operation that's running in Syria. So that gives us an indication of just how severe things are in this country. You know, it is a humanitarian crisis, and there are very, very few Venezuelans who see it as anything else but.
And on top of the water shortages and the blackouts, yesterday Maduro announced that Venezuela's electricity is going to be rationed to combat those daily blackouts. How do Venezuelans feel about that?
30-day program of rationing. Then they're furious. Many Venezuelans are absolutely furious about this situation. You'll see videos online of people taking to the streets and demanding change, calling for water. Just they want the basics. Of course, you know, we think, well, an electricity blackout, that's frustrating. But sometimes, unless you're living through it, you forget just what life is like without electricity. In this country, because all of the water involves being pumped, you know, into tall apartment blocks or up to the shanty towns, there are a lot of people who just don't have basic water provision either because of the electricity blackout. So if you've got no refrigeration and the little food that you have is rotting in the fridges, you can't get online. You know, it's everything. So it is an extremely exhausting situation for ordinary Venezuelans. The idea that it's going to go on for another month is very tiring. But of course, most think it will go on well beyond that, too.
Well, in a moment, we'll hear how some Venezuelans are finding a way around those problems. The BBC's Will Grant in Caracas. Will, thanks for being there and for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Very well, Marco.
As we just heard, Venezuelans are in a constant struggle to meet their basic day-to-day needs. Water, electricity, food, medicine. It's all left many Venezuelans with a hard choice. Do we stay in the country or do we leave? The World's Carol Hills reached out to two women with different answers to that question.
Mino Reyes is a retired architect and a proud Venezuelan. She lives with her husband in Caracas, where she says the situation has become extreme.
You don't know what's going to happen, you know, the next 2 hours. This lack of stability of you don't know if you can take a shower, if you can prepare your breakfast, or if you're going to find transportation, or if tomorrow you're going to work or not. It's a very, very, scaring situation.
For decades, Mino worked as an architect, designing public sector projects like hospitals and schools. These days, there's no work, so she volunteers at her alma mater, Simón Bolívar University. It used to be one of the most prestigious science and technical schools in Latin America. Now it's open just a few hours a day and hasn't had water for almost 4 months. Mino is determined to save her university, so she spends her days finding alternative sources of water and generators to keep the lights on. Her five sisters all live abroad, and most of the time they can't get through to her to find out if she's okay. Mino says she often has to wander through the streets of Caracas to find a signal to use WhatsApp. That's usually the only thing that works.
You cannot go to a store and buy any food or anything you need because there's no power, they're closed, or if they're open, you have to pay in cash. And with this hyperinflation, there's no way you can have enough to buy anything you need.
The power shortages mean that food in refrigerators is starting to rot. Mino's getting a generator to use at home, and she counts herself lucky that she can afford one. But when I asked if she's ready to leave Venezuela, like millions of her fellow citizens have already done, Mino says no way. She's in it for the long haul.
I'm going to stay here. I'm going to continue working. I think this is a beautiful country that have many, many possibilities. It's a future of brightness, and I'm going to be here to see that, and I'm going to be here to help to do that.
Valentina Aguana feels differently. She's 20 and a current student at Simón Bolívar University studying computer engineering.
Thanks to the recent blackouts, I haven't been able to go to my university since March 7th.
As you can hear, that Skype connection was rough. But here's Valentina's story. She lives with her mother and helps to support her and her extended family by doing freelance tech work. But now she's afraid to turn her computer on because if there's a blackout or power surge, it could wreck it. Valentina says she hasn't had running water at her home in over a week. They have a water tank, but it's nearly dry. A few months ago, Valentina was optimistic. Juan Guaido had declared himself president. She could imagine then that there was a way for Venezuela to get out of the crisis. But then nothing much happened.
At this very moment, after these past 3 weeks of national blackouts, I think the general perception of the crisis among Venezuelans is hopeless.
Hopeless, she says. Valentina doesn't see an end in sight. Now she's thinking of leaving Venezuela. She says the stress of being a foreigner in a new country would be nothing compared to the risks of staying in Caracas. She actually believes she could die if she stays. If she gets sick and ends up in a hospital, what if there's no power and no medicine? Crime is rampant. She worries about taking a wrong turn on the street.
If I go out, I don't know, in the wrong time, I can be killed by someone trying to steal something from me. I mean, the situation is just Mad Max.
You know Mad Max, the movie about a dystopian future. Valentina says her family used to be middle class and was doing okay. But 2 or 3 years ago, everything changed. Now they're struggling to put food on the table. She says maybe if she went abroad, she could get work with her computer skills and then send money home. At least that way, she'd actually be of more help to her family. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
Finding out exactly what is going on in Venezuela is hard, and that goes for people inside and outside the country. That's why many Venezuelans and expats around the world are turning to this. This is from an app called Zello.
It's like a walkie-talkie, and people can choose to just listen, or people can choose to also speak.
That's Maria. She's a creator and a moderator of one of the most popular channels on Zello that provides Venezuelans with one commodity they desperately need, reliable information. Maria asks us to use only her first name because she fears for her family back in Venezuela. That's where she's from. She's been in the U.S. for the past 2 decades. I asked her to take us back to the day when she created this Zello channel.
In February of 2014, there was a social explosion in Venezuela. It was anti-government. And someone told me, download this app and you will be able to hear what's happening. And I was stunned. You could hear, you were there. You could hear shots being shot. Mm. You could hear people yelling and screaming. It was like if you were almost there. And so a group of us created the channel to provide information about the situation in Venezuela from a political, social, economic, and humanitarian point of view.
Well, one of the reasons Venezuelans are tuning in is to hear news they might not hear on media in Venezuela. For example, on Friday night, there was a breaking news alert that I got on my phone. The Red Cross had just been granted access to deliver aid in Venezuela. And then a minute later, this went out on your Zello channel.
Venezuela accedió a dejar a la Cruz Roja.
Yes, we are monitoring the news 24/7. As you probably know, all the media in Venezuela has been taken by the Chavista regime of Maduro. So we, as moderators and even our channel users, are constantly searching for information. If we get a piece of information that hasn't been checked, we say this is not confirmed. And everyone starts sort of digging to see if they can find the truth. Mm. That's one thing that I think we have been doing very well and why our channel has been so successful.
Broadcasting news and information, though, is just one aspect of your channel. I gather Venezuelans are also using Zello to get things like medical supplies and food.
Yes, a lot of it is people sort of trying to find out where they can get some food, where is a gas station where there is a line that is less than 5 hours. There is one of our users who has a hearing aid and it broke, and we were able to find her one that was donated. This person has zero money to buy anything, never mind, even if you have the money, you probably couldn't find it. Mm. Also, we, the students and the protesters, really trust us. When they are out protesting, they have the app open and our channel open, and they're hearing what's happening. And we have been able to tell them to avoid a certain area or a certain street because the armed forces are coming. We believe that we've saved lives because of this.
So how often are you tuned into this channel?
I am connected to my channel 24/7. I literally sleep with my earphones on. And I will say my husband wasn't very happy with the fact that he was sometimes speaking to me and I wasn't even paying attention because I was paying attention to my Zello channel. So that it brought a little bit of strain in our relationship. And so what I do now is when my husband is in my presence, I don't speak, but I am always listening because the fact that I'm not in Venezuela and I cannot help, at least by being in my channel in Zello and helping people and providing them with information, I feel like that's my way of helping. And I really feel like I'm making a difference.
That was Maria, the creator of a Zello channel that many Venezuelans and expats use to get news and other information. And a thanks to Wired Magazine for helping us with that interview. You can find their in-depth story, How Zello Became a Lifeline for Venezuelans Under Maduro, pinned to our Facebook page. That's PRI, the world. Just ahead, the fraught situation at the U.S.-Mexican border and the view from the former U.S. ambassador to Mexico who resigned last year. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Trump has a lot of go-to punching bags, but one of his favorites these days, Mexico. In a recent tweet, he writes, Mexico is doing nothing to help stop the flow of illegal immigrants to our country. They are all talk and no action. Trump is also threatening to close the U.S. southern border if Mexico doesn't stop Central American migrants from heading north. Official Mexico's response to all this? A shrug. Emily Green reports from Mexico City.
On the campaign trail, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said he'd respond to President Trump's harsh comments about Mexico, tweet for tweet. He said Trump would learn to respect Mexico. But as President, López Obrador, or AMLO as he's known, is taking a different approach. Here he is just this morning at his daily news conference.
Aquí estamos nosotros decididos a mantener una buena relación, una relación.
We are committed to keeping a good relationship with the U.S., he says, one of friendship, cooperation, and mutual help. We are not going to fall to any provocation. This approach makes sense, says Esteban Ayades, a political analyst in Mexico City.
In a nutshell, AMLO doesn't really want to start a fight with Trump, knowing that it won't really lead anywhere. I mean, if he answers back, Trump will just escalate the rhetoric and AMLO won't get very much out of it. On the contrary, I think it will just make things worse.
There's a lot on the line for Mexico, like the updated NAFTA agreement, which still hasn't been ratified. Gretchen Kuhner runs an immigrant rights group in Mexico City. She says López Obrador backs a regional policy to tackle migration from Central America, including a program to give Central Americans a way to work, legally, in Mexico. But none of this helps what's happening now, with thousands of people heading through Mexico toward the U.S.
So while more people are staying in Mexico to request asylum than ever before, many people are also arriving at the U.S. border.
And when it comes to how Mexico treats migrants moving through its country, that's where things are tricky. Carlos Bravo Regidor is a professor at CIDE, a university in Mexico City. He says Mexico wants to have it both ways.
On the one hand, of course, Central American immigrants, I think it's clear that this government, at least in principle, wants a policy that is more sensible to their situation, to the emergency that they're facing, and more respectful of their rights. On the other hand, this administration wants to play ball with the U.S.
It's also not true, Bravo Regidor says, that Mexico isn't doing anything to stop migrants. After all, Mexico is also deporting more Central Americans than the U.S. For The World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
I asked Roberta Jacobson for her take on the U.S.-Mexico relationship. She's among the top diplomatic experts on Latin America and was U.S. ambassador to Mexico until she resigned last year. Ambassador, you were, I know, a great champion of cooperation with Mexico. Mexico now wants more cooperation under Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the new president. Why do you think AMLO, as he's known, was critical of Trump when he was campaigning? And now that he's president of Mexico, he seems to be supporting Trump, or at least wants kind of back in the orbit.
Obviously, people campaign differently than they govern. And you're right, he campaigned in a more aggressive fashion. But he was pretty careful not to make his campaign too personal vis-a-vis the president in the U.S. But he also told me that he believed the relationship with the United States was the most important thing that he needed to address. And therefore, he was going to do everything he could to keep that relationship positive.
You'd been a diplomat for 30 years, served under five presidents. Why did you quit under Trump?
Well, for me, it became increasingly difficult to defend some of the administration's policies. But it also is a question of when you feel you have influence and whether you think you're going to have more influence outside. And unfortunately, I got to a point where I felt that I was not having the influence that I wanted to, and therefore it was time to go.
I'm curious to know, Ambassador, how much has your concern about the border changed since you left your tenure as ambassador to Mexico? Like when you held that post, how much were you thinking about the border, immigration numbers, detentions, all that?
We thought about it a lot for a lot of different reasons. One was clearly migration. Migration levels were at the lowest in many decades, and we believed that we knew what worked. What worked was cooperating with the Mexican government that was returning people to Central America. And what worked in Central America was assistance programs that reduced insecurity and increased economic opportunity and prevented kids from going into gangs. My concern at this point comes from an administration that seems disinclined to cooperate, but also the government of Mexico is talking about reducing their enforcement efforts. And I think the two things, unfortunately, have combined to make a perfect storm where migrants think, I'll be able to cross Mexico because this new president seems more inclined not to return me. And I may not be able to get into the United States if I don't go now. All of those are drivers north.
Is Trump devoting too many resources to stemming immigration and not enough resources to the humanitarian crisis at the border?
He's devoting the wrong resources. That's what I would say. It is not a question of devoting military resources. You have to devote resources to the source countries. And we've already seen those numbers for assistance to those countries go down. One day after Secretary Nielsen signs a regional compact with Central American countries to stem migration, the president announces he wants not a penny more to go to those countries. So it's also this herky-jerky, what one Mexican official called schizophrenia of our policy of engaging on one day and cutting off on the next that also helps to drive this increased migration.
What do you say to people who see that cooperation, as we've had it so far, hasn't really delivered what the U.S. needs, primarily calm and order at the border?
Well, I'm not sure that it was given much of a chance with this new government in Mexico because they've only been in office 4 months. But I would also say again that the changing focus in the U.S. policy and the schizophrenia, if you will, leaves everybody confused. And it makes your cooperation not meaningless, but less effective.
I almost don't want to ask this, but I really have to. You may have heard this. Over the weekend, Fox ran a banner that said Trump cuts aid to 3 Mexican countries. I mean, it's hard to imagine that was anything but a production mistake, but don't you think it shows that there is still a basic lack of understanding in the U.S. about the whole region?
Well, I do think it was a production error. I don't want to read too much more into it, but I will say that I have been hearing for years from Americans along the U.S.-Mexican border that neither Mexico City nor Washington understands the border. And I think the same is true for many Americans in terms of understanding the Northern Triangle countries or other countries in Central and Latin America. But I do think if we listened a little more, we might get it right more often than we get it wrong.
Roberta Jacobson was the U.S. ambassador to Mexico until her resignation last year. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. The NATO military alliance turned 70 this week. President Trump has questioned its value to the U.S., but for countries like Estonia, the value is obvious.
One of the things we cannot change is geography. And the fact of the matter is that we are on the boundary between NATO and Russia.
A chat with Estonia's ambassador to Washington. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I don't live in the UK. I'm not a British citizen. But if you're like me and see Brexit as this dense blob of unrequited policy, maybe you're also starting to feel sorry for the Brits. Embattled British Prime Minister Theresa May appeared outside No. 10 Downing Street today.
I've just come from chairing 7 hours of cabinet meetings, focused on finding a route out of the current impasse.
The impasse, or impasse, of course, being Brexit, and the British Parliament's inability to approve a plan, any plan, for leaving the European Union. The World's Orla Barry is in London. Oh, what did May say after today's marathon session?
Well, the Prime Minister told us that she was going to seek a delay on Brexit, but also, perhaps more significantly, she said that she's willing to sit down with the opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
And to try to agree a plan that we would both stick to ensure that we leave the European Union and that we do so with a deal. Any plan?
What's interesting here is that she's indicating that she's moving away from this idea of a very hard Brexit and towards a compromise in many ways. She's not a woman who's been known to compromise in the past, and this is a little bit of a pivot by her by indicating that she's going to move away from the hardliners within her own party. It's hard to know what she will agree with and what will get agreement across the House then in future, and indeed what the EU will then agree with, because as far as they were concerned, they drew up a withdrawal deal that they said was negotiated for a very long time, and that is a deal that they were very slow to change.
Will the EU be okay with this?
So Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, said this evening just after Theresa May made her statement that, you know, he tweeted, even after today, we don't know what the end result will be, but let us be patient. So he's kind of appealing across to other EU leaders, let us be patient.
What about Theresa May's own political standing, Orla?
tonight when she was making the speech at 10 Downing Street, she very much put herself into the position of, you know, I'm alone in reaching out to the public and understanding your frustration on this, and I'm trying to get compromise across the House.
This is a difficult time for everyone. Passions are running high on all sides of the argument. But we can and must find the compromises that will deliver what the British people voted for. This is a decisive moment in the story of these islands, and it requires national unity to deliver the national interest.
The reality is, because she can get very little support from within her own party, you know, we know there's many who would like to see her go. But at this stage, she's still standing, but certainly her popularity within the party couldn't be any lower.
Well, I'm assuming we can expect more twists and turns in the coming days and weeks. The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks again.
Thanks, Marco.
This week, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, celebrates its 70th anniversary. It's been an awkward time recently for the alliance. President Trump has lambasted NATO allies, often for not spending more on their militaries. But this week is about honoring NATO. The Secretary General of the alliance, Jens Stoltenberg, met Trump at the White House today. Tomorrow, Stoltenberg addresses a joint session of Congress. The speeches and ceremonies are a way of reminding people what NATO is all about. 7 decades of democratic countries upholding Western principles and committing to defend each other from attack. That would be the blurb on the dust cover. Here's the world's Chris Wolf with the whole story.
NATO was born out of war, World War II, and a desire to prevent another war. Nicholas Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO.
The West European countries had largely been destroyed by World War II. If the United States and the West European countries and Canada hadn't formed the alliance on April 4th, 1949, there's every reason to believe the Soviets would have pushed further into the democracies of Western Europe, and the United States could not let that happen. So this was a treaty in the self-interest of the United States as well as Canada and the European countries.
The treaty was signed in Washington on April 4th, 1949. President Harry S. Truman spoke for the United States at the ceremony.
If there is anything certain today, if there is anything inevitable in the future, it is the will of the people of the world for freedom and for peace.
The U.S. had never had a defensive alliance in peacetime before. The Founding Fathers had warned against foreign entanglements, and that resistance continued into the 1940s. NATO's Founding Fathers, like Secretary of State Dean Acheson, had to win the support of Congress and the American people.
From Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson calls on the free world to unite against aggression in his first Atlantic Pact address.
The Atlantic Pact is a collective self-defense arrangement among the countries of the North Atlantic area. It is a simple fact, proved by experience, that an outside attack upon one member of this community is an attack upon all members.
Acheson's argument for collective self-defense is enshrined in Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty. The idea was to deter Soviet attack, and Ambassador Nicholas Burns says it worked.
NATO was extraordinarily successful because it was able to deter the Soviet Union and later modern Russia from thinking of a conventional attack into Western Europe. That was a real danger.
Now, NATO had plenty of ups and downs and opposition, especially in Western Europe. But after 40 years of stubborn containment of Soviet power, NATO got this.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Good evening, everyone. From the west side of the Berlin Wall at the Brandenburg Gate, I'm Tom Brokaw. The Brandenburg Gate, of course, is in East Berlin, and the sound that you hear and what you're seeing tonight, not hammers and sickles, but hammers and chisels as young people take down this wall bit by bit.
The Berlin Wall, that symbol of the division of Europe, came crashing down in 1989. The Soviet Union itself collapsed 2 years later. It was a critical crossroads for NATO. Some said it should simply disband. But under the Clinton administration, NATO and the European Union expanded eastward, in part to fill the power vacuum in Eastern Europe. Ambassador Burns again.
And this was, I think, one of the greatest things that NATO has ever done. And it's why NATO is relevant today in 2019, because if we had not extended this security guarantee of NATO to the East European countries, you can bet that the Russian Federation would be seeking to dominate them today, but Russia cannot.
Not everyone agrees.
The project of eastward expansion, I think, is at the root of a lot of the problems that we are facing today vis-a-vis Russia.
That's James Carden, a former advisor to the State Department on Russia.
The problem, as became very clear towards the end of the 90s, is that Russia wasn't going to react very well to the idea that the alliance was going to expand right to its westernmost border.
Ivo Dolder has his own thoughts on this. He's another former U.S. ambassador to NATO.
Well, Russia is Russia. I think the Russia we're seeing today under Vladimir Putin is not that different from the Russia we have seen over the course of history, a country somewhat insecure in its own borders and seeking security by expanding its reach to its neighboring countries. NATO expansion is not what produced that. Russia's own history and its own behavior is what has produced it.
That brings us to Donald Trump.
23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying.
Donald Trump's NATO debut in May 2017. He criticized America's allies for failing to pay their way, as have other presidents, but he falsely claimed they owe the U.S. money. Trump also failed to voice support for Article 5, the one-for-all and all-for-one guarantee at the heart of NATO.
It's so unhelpful when he's kicking our most important allies in the ass publicly and doing things that are not helpful.
That's Lieutenant General Ben Hodges speaking on this program last week. Hodges was commander of the U.S. Army in Europe till his retirement from the service in 2017.
I never in my life imagined an American president would call into question Article 5. That's unbelievable to me, and it's causing people to have to do a lot of extra work to explain, don't worry, we're still committed, you know, we're here.
Trump administration officials have reaffirmed U.S. commitment to NATO and Article 5, but some analysts are asking if NATO is now at another crossroads. For the World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
Estonia joined NATO in 2004. Estonia, remember, is a former Soviet state, and it eagerly remade itself into a modern Western country after the end of the Cold War. Joining NATO not only affirmed that transformation, it helped with a major security threat, Estonia's shared border with Russia. Jonathan Savioff is Estonia's ambassador to the United States. Ambassador, thanks for being with us. First of all, what is NATO's current commitment to your country?
Well, the NATO commitment, of course, is ironclad. Article 5, collective defense, is the backbone of our security, also the backbone of European and transatlantic security. We're convinced that NATO is as strong as it has ever been, actually getting stronger every day. The decisions we've made in the past few years have put us back on the path of safeguarding European and transatlantic security. We're very happy with the way things have developed in the alliance, and we're looking forward to the important meetings this week, as well as later on this year when the heads of state come together, and hope to see more good decisions on collective defense.
Ambassador, you said NATO's commitment to Estonia is ironclad. You believe that despite President Trump's critiques of the alliance?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We believe that, and we also want to assure everybody that our commitment to NATO and Article 5 is ironclad. NATO's posture is not only composed of words. And even though sometimes words may be used liberally, what NATO is much more than just rhetorics. NATO is bigger than just any administration, any president, any foreign minister. NATO has been around for 70 years. It's had ups and downs. It's faced down the Soviet challenge. And NATO will certainly face down future challenges as well, not because of partisan politics, but because of the fundamental values and interests that bring European and North American democracies together. So I'm confident that everything that brought us together 70 years ago is still valid, even more so today than it was maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago.
As far as Estonia goes, would you say that Estonia's biggest security threat is your neighbor, Russia?
Well, there are some things that we can change and some things we cannot change. One of the things we cannot change is geography. And the fact of the matter is that we are situated on the boundary between NATO and Russia. And the fact of life, unfortunately, also is that Russia is assertive when it comes to its foreign policy. So we obviously take Russia very seriously. We are not anti-Russian. NATO is not anti-Russian. But NATO is absolutely committed to safeguarding and securing every square feet of its territory. That includes Estonia's territory, which just happens to be next to Russia. Russia is a major influence on our security, yes.
We saw Russia go into Crimea and annex it. What would happen if Vladimir Putin tried to claw part of Estonia into Russia? Can you imagine a scenario where that might happen?
I can assure you that we, as well as our American friends and allies, as well as all of NATO, take every potential scenario very seriously. And that over the past few years, and as we speak today, we play through these scenarios at our exercises, tabletop exercises, at our discussions with government officials. So we prepare for every scenario, including the most unlikely and the most serious ones. So I'm confident that nothing like this will ever happen in Estonia for as long as we keep on doing what we've been doing in the past few years.
Article 5, the Collective Defense Clause, it's only been invoked once after September 11th. If it were used again,
indeed,
say at the request of Estonia in response to Russian aggression, do you believe the entire alliance, crucially the United States, would come to Estonia's help?
Yes, we do. But more importantly, we need to convince others of this. Just us believing in Article 5 is not enough, unfortunately.
What others are you specifically referring to?
Every other non-NATO nation in the world, everybody who might entertain ideas of attacking a NATO ally, they need to be convinced that when attacking NATO, NATO would respond.
There's always room for improvement, right? Where has NATO fallen down?
Well, there are a number of areas where we need to continue our work. One of them, obviously made famous by President Trump, is defense spending. Article 5 of the Washington Treaty is the Collective Defense Clause. Article 3, which is for some reason less famous, talks about every ally's responsibility for their own defense. Defense spending is crucially important, and there is room for improvement there.
Estonia, it's interesting, is one of the few NATO members that is not in arrears on defense spending for the alliance. Do you push your other member states to step it up?
Oh, yes, we do. We've done so since before the subject became as famous as it has become now. 2%, that is considered to be the minimum for us to be able to sustain sufficient military capabilities. Estonia right now is above 2% of GDP. Other allies are either at or moving towards the 2% goal.
Ambassador Savioev, could Estonia survive without NATO?
Well, I guess we could ask the same question about every ally. The fact that we have all voluntarily joined this alliance means that we all think that we are better off with NATO. I truly believe this to be the case, obviously for Estonia, but also for the United States and every other ally. This is the main organization, the only military alliance that brings Western democracies together.
Jonathan Savioev is Estonia's ambassador in Washington. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Happy Equal Pay Day, people, at least in the U.S. If you calculate the pay gap between women and men in the U.S., you'd find that women have to work an extra 92 days to earn what men made in the calendar year 2018. In other words, today is the day when women actually start catching up to what men made last year. Yeah, it sucks. And that's just an average. Black women in the U.S. have to work until late August to make parity, and Latinas, November. But there's another employment issue looming for women, and that's automation. The World's Allison Herrera has been looking into this. What have you found, Allison?
Well, Marco, there's a study that came out recently that says nearly half of all jobs are at risk from automation by the year 2030, and that women are more likely to be affected by that than men. That study is by the Institute for Women's Policy and Research. They're a think tank in Washington that looks at economic security for women.
That is a little surprising. What jobs are at risk that women might be moved out of by robots and automation?
We're talking about things like the cashier at your local grocery store. You know, you've seen those self-checkout lanes at Stop and Shop, Walgreens, and Target, jobs like office assistant, administrative assistant. These are jobs at risk to automation, and they're jobs typically done by women.
Are there jobs that women are more likely to do that are not at risk from automation?
Yeah, things like childcare, caring for the elderly. But those are really low-paid jobs. Ariane Hegovich is one of the authors of the study, and this is what she had to say about that.
We really need to invest more in those care jobs, because we can't have a society where everybody is the software engineer. We need care work, but care work is dramatically underpaid.
I am hearing, though, Allison, that some countries like Japan are experimenting with robots to take care of the elderly. Will this put some jobs, even jobs that demand face-to-face presence, at risk?
Well, you're right. Japan is experimenting. They're using robots to lead some stretching exercises and maybe hand out pills and do some light companion work. But it's mainly a job that a human has to do, and it's more likely to be a woman.
So how do you think women will deal with this if their already low-paid jobs are going to get challenged by automation?
Well, training for better jobs is one solution. Higher paying jobs that require education. This also might help with the pay disparity too. But the Institute warns that sometimes women don't stay in those higher paying jobs because they often feel forced out by their male colleagues, or they're the ones taking care of the kids.
And we got to remember, there is no equal pay day for robots. You take away the initial costs and they work for free, right?
Yeah, yes, you're right.
The World's Allison Herrera. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, scientists in Vancouver, British Columbia, recently made a discovery about honey that comes from urban beehives there and what that honey says about air pollution in the city. The World's Brandy Fullwood explains.
When you're in a city buying honey, a few things may come to mind that are influencing your decision.
It all begins in a field where worker
honey, sourced straight from the hive, is one of nature's perfect superfoods.
Lush fields and rolling hills with fresh flowers, that's where honey comes from, right? It's like the honey's supposed to be funneled straight from the comb into your tea. Around the corner, though, there's a strong possibility that your neighbor in the city that you live in is probably making honey. That's because urban honey is thriving, and there's now the surge of people trying it out. In Vancouver, they're trying it out through Hives for Humanity.
At first, I wasn't sure about working for Hives for Humanity because I'm afraid of bees, but over the years, I've come to like them.
That's Horace, or Bear Whisperer. He's been building habitats and gardens for bees with Hives for Humanity for the past couple of years. Hives for Humanity is kind of like a multi-purpose community garden. They're trying to create this sense of connection to the city and the environment by teaching people about beekeeping and garden maintenance, how to make honey in their own neighborhood. But Sarah Komen, who founded the organization with her mom, says that beekeeping in the city, it has some pushbacks.
We were facing some comments, you know, like offhand comments that people would make, kind of questioning the quality of our honey.
Sarah and her mom end up connecting with a friend of a friend who just so happens to be this geochemical researcher from UBC, or University of British Columbia. Dominic Weiss, the researcher, and her team were
able to... just 1 second. Geochemical research, what does that have to do with all of this?
So Dominique Weiss, who's the lead researcher at UBC, she basically looked into what types of metals could be in this honey. They're looking at cadmium, they're looking at zinc, they're looking into lead. That turned into this bigger project of urban pollution to begin with. So that's where it all started from.
Gotcha. Thanks for the explanation. All right, carry on.
The key question they had was, is the honey produced by the community there clean?
That's Dominique. I still wanted to know, why? Why do they need to know if the honey was clean? I kept thinking there might be some unheard of climate issue in Vancouver, but no. Dominique said that Vancouver actually is one of the cleanest cities. So when I reached out to Sarah from Hives for Humanity, she said that the initial question was put out there to put rumors to rest.
Often the perception is that something like delicious, safe, free of contamination, urban honey, like, couldn't come from this neighborhood.
Hives for Humanity is located in the downtown east side of Vancouver.
The downtown east side is disproportionately the Indigenous representation.
The Indigenous representation in this case are many First Nations people nearby from the tribal lands that Vancouver's on. And there's also this high population of immigrants from Mexico and the Philippines. A lot of people of color live in this neighborhood. Sarah says that outsiders often perceive this neighborhood as, well, bad.
Because they are Indigenous, because they are homeless, because they are a person who experiences barriers to mental health, because they're a person who uses drugs.
These are absolutely issues, but one of the knock-on effects of this perception of the neighborhood is that whole groups of people, whole demographics of people, including Hives for Humanity, are treated with suspicion. And that prejudice is funneled straight back into their honeycomb. people thought or they think that honey from urban neighborhoods like the downtown East Side isn't clean. Of course, that's not true, but it's why they felt like the research for urban clean honey needed to be conducted in the first place.
It's a thing we knew, but through this project, we've now been able to show that it's totally safe and that this like beautiful product is coming out of this neighborhood.
Okay, urban gardens, beekeeping, you name it, it's having a moment.
In an ultra-lush urban garden in Cambridge.
And even the advertisers are backing them up this time.
Flowers are blooming everywhere. Even in a city area.
For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Pure, real, true.
And that's where we leave things on the world today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.